Okay, so let me thank, first of all, for the invitation to come here to the conference. Is the mic switched on, or am I supposed to switch it on? I think it is on. Okay. So we had recently some fun talking to the high-energy physics people. I mean, we met Uwe Jens Wiese, actually, at one of the programs here at KITB some time ago. And in this context, I mean, Uwe Jens Wiese is really a high-energy theorist, and he's an expert for lattice gauge theories. And he's one of the inventors of the so-called quantum link models. And for us, it was then quite an amusing and interesting discussion to ask the question, can we do an atomic quantum simulator of some of these quantum link models? And the outcome of all of that has been, you know, two papers. One came out, I think, 3 months ago. Another one is in print at the moment. And I would like to give you sort of a qualitative summary of some of these ideas, but also talk about some newer stuff that we're doing right now, like these things listed down here. So most of the talk will be about atoms, but, you know, we also thought about superconductors. I don't really have time to talk about the superconducting ideas in this context, but maybe there's time during the program to talk about these things. Okay, so the goal of all of this was to come up with very simple models of lattice gauge theories, abelian and also non-abelian, and then ask to what extent we can find atomic realizations. And of course, the motivation for all of this is sort of the very ultimate vision that we would have in the similar way to having developed connection with condensed matter physicists. Maybe at one point we can also, you know, build something like a quantum simulator that's useful in the context of high-energy theory. And of course, you know, when we talk about lattice gauge theory, I mean, this is a fundamental gauge symmetry. The standard model, I mean, every force has its gauge boson, and so it's based on that. And the present understanding that we have is quite often essentially based on the fact that if you map, for example, quantum chromodynamics onto a lattice over here, you can have mapped these things into something which is actually a classical statistical mechanics problem, which allows actually classical Monte Carlo simulations. There's a long list of achievements over here, but there's also certain things that cannot be done, like finite density, quantum chromodynamics, real-time evolution, all of that. So in some sense, you might ask at this point, you know, can we do quantum simulation with atoms that might address some of these things? And of course, the disclaimer right away from the beginning is this, that what we're doing at the moment is to think at very little, we think of very simple, actually toy model and also simple phenomena in this context. So it's not the real thing we are doing right now. We are doing something which is, you know, a simplified version, but maybe nonetheless has some of the flavors that may be of interest in this context. When you think of lattice gauge theory, the basic structure is that we think about lattices over here, where we have actually matter fields sitting on the different sides. These are the blue ones over here. And we got the gauge fields that sit on the links. What we're interested in our context is a Hamiltonian formulation, because this is the one that we can, at the end, map over to the atomic side by Kogut and Susskind, I mean, quite some time ago. And the goal is sort of, you know, to think about abelian as well as non-abelian lattice gauge theories. Quantum electrodynamics would be an example of the U1 gauge symmetry. Quantum chromodynamics, you would have something like a SU3 or the SUN, as we discussed it in the following. And the essential point is that we have, of course, a gauge symmetry as a local symmetry. So I'll talk about these things afterwards in some more detail. But if you take this thing over here, the goal that we have is to map this thing in some form to atomic systems. And of course, a very good candidate would be optical lattices. We have atoms in optical lattices, and maybe many of you are aware of the developments in the context of what we call analog simulation with Hubbard models. Maybe put cold fermionic and also bosonic atoms into optical lattices, and we know how to engineer corresponding Hamiltonian. So that the big challenge, of course, here is this, that how do we map gauge symmetry in a way that, you know, is at the end then actually meaningful over to the right-hand side. So of course, what will come out at the end is always that we have here some sort of emergence lattice gauge theory. So the symmetries can never be satisfied exactly. There will always be some deviations. And of course, we hope that these deviations at the very end will be small. But this will be a major part of what we'll talk about now in the following. Now, this is grand goal over here. And of course, we want to do these things for some very simple models. And as I mentioned already before, Uwe Jens Wiese introduced us to what he calls himself the quantum link models. And there's quite some literature in the context of particle physics, papers that he and others wrote about 10 to 15 years ago. And of course, I should right away say that there's also a lot of connections with, for example, on the quant-mat side in terms of spin ice, quantum spin liquids, and so on. Even though I would say that in this context over here, it's not so much the non-abelian part, it's more abelian lattice gauge theories that people have actually considered. So let me right away give you the most simple example. This would be an example of putting quantum electrodynamics onto a lattice, where we represent the corresponding gauge fields over here by, for example, spins. So the spins have, of course, a finite dimensional Hilbert space, and the quantum link models are sort of a simplified version or a special version of lattice gauge theories, where these gauge fields live in finite dimensional spaces. But of course, they can also have abelian version. There's a non-abelian version. So all of these things like SUN, UN, U1, and so on, we are able to do in a context like here. But of course, this is just the U1 example that I'm plotting here. So the condensed matter people will right away recognize that the part, which is the spin part over here, is of course nothing else but what you call the spin ice, or which I should actually call it here, the so-called quantum spin ice, representing the electromagnetic field. But what we will do in the following is also that we include actually fermions in this context, fermions hopping around between the lattice sites, so that at the very end you really get, you know, matter interacting with some gauge fields, which in the simplified model is represented by a certain spin of some value, like 1/2, 1, 3/2, and so on. So the nice thing about these special models over here is this, that they have rather natural, under quote, implementations with cold atoms in optical lattices, because they have certain properties that sort of, you know, map easily, maybe I shouldn't really use the word easy here, over to the kind of models that we know how to do in the context of atomic physics. But let me just give you examples. I mean, we wrote this paper recently, as I said, which is on the abelian lattice gauge theory, where we essentially took spins over here, like a spin one, and we asked ourselves, can we implement the model like this, where we have fermions hopping around, interacting with a spin, representing the radiation field or the photons over here. And one way of doing that, for example, will be, and I'll elaborate on these things afterwards, to represent the spin in terms of what we call actually Schwinger bosons. So this could be bosonic atoms over here, fermionic atoms that provide all of the ingredients to mimic then the corresponding lattice gauge theory dynamics. So it's really then the world from the atomic physics point of view of atomic boson Fermi mixtures in optical lattices and some special engineering of these lattices that we will do at the very end. I have to say that, you know, when we wrote this paper at the very beginning, we had some rather complicated setups in mind, and it turns out when you go to the UN or the SUN non-abelian lattice gauge theory, it turns out that we sort of learned on the way that some of these things could actually even be simplified. For example, if you do non-abelian lattice gauge theory in the so-called quantum link models, again, you got fermions representing the matter field that can hop around between the lattice sites. But actually, the gauge bosons that sit in between here, you can see up here in the case of the Schwinger bosons, we represent here the spin by some sort of a double well potential. So Schwinger bosons can sit on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side over here. And there's a similar representation down here, which has the UN and also the SUN, which leads at the very end to fermions sitting over here, representing what Ubi and Spiesier called in his paper fermionic regions. And of course, so we have the matter field, the fermions here, we got the regions over here, but all of these things is now fermions, it's representing some sort of a color index here that goes maybe from 1 to 3, if you want to do SU3 as an example. And then we have certain dynamics on lattices like this. So here, the problem comes down to doing multi-species, you know, with three internal states, Fermi gases that sit on these lattices that we have here. So from an atomic physics point of view, these kind of models that I'm talking about here are relatively tough to implement, but I would say that they are not unrealistic. And the hope is, of course, by, you know, doing some of these things in the lab, eventually, you know, we might be able to mimic some of the physics of lattice gauge theory in an interesting way. So after this overview that I gave you over here, let me now focus into something that I will give you the AMO perspective on this thing. You know what the central part of all of these things are, namely if you write down Hamiltonians that have certain gauge symmetries that are local symmetries, there will be associated certain conservation laws, which is the Gauss law over here. And so at the very end of the day, we will see the challenge will be to implement Hamiltonians that have certain local symmetries, which are the ones that we want, and then have actually certain constraints represented by the Gauss law. So it's Hamiltonians plus constraints, how do we implement these things in a controlled fashion. And in the following example, I will illustrate these things in the context of this spin ice, you know, representing the electromagnetic field coupled to matter in some form, which would be the fermions hopping around. And this question of these local symmetries or the Gauss law will essentially be at the very end that, you know, we have certain constraints which are fundamental in the context of a lattice gauge theory. which can be written in this simple example over here. It's just a Gauss law that we know from quantum electrodynamics, which is, of course, locally valid. It's a statement about, you know, the state of these spins relative to this fermion that we have in the middle representing the matter. And so this means that in our implementations, what we always have is we got some big Hilbert space over here, which may contain all of these microscopic degrees of freedom, but we have to impose constraints at the same time, you know, that make sure that we actually remain in the gauge invariant subspace over here. So putting constraints on will be essential, and it will afterwards tell you different ideas of how to achieve that. Okay, so let me give you maybe a short introduction, very much from the atomic physics point of view, on these lattice gauge theories. At the moment, there's a lot of interest, and it's kind of a hot topic, to talk about bosons or fermions living on the lattice, 2D, with some external field, you know, which corresponds to a certain flux, a certain magnetic field. Of course, in the case of atoms, atoms are not charged, so we have to make these external magnetic fields in an artificial way. And this is called a synthetic gauge field problem, and there's different proposals out there how to do that, and at the moment it's a hot topic to work on these kind of things. But the hope is that with cold atoms and lattices, we might see things like, you know, not only the Hofstadter butterfly, but also fractional quantum Hall effect, fractional Chern insulate, and all of these kind of things here. So let me take this as the entrance point to talk about the lattice gauge theory, in the sense that, of course, here the external field that we put in is one which actually prescribed as a classical external field. So the kind of Hamiltonians that we would write here would be, you know, some fermion, some boson hopping between different lattice sites. And of course, this thing, while it hops over, sort of maybe hopping around the plaquette over here, it picks up a certain phase, which, you know, involves the vector potential over here. And of course, you know, if you walk around here, the corresponding phase that the particle will be actually picking up corresponds to the flux, which is enclosed in the plaquette, which is, of course, the basis of this physics which we have over here. Now, here the field is treated classically, but if you now go to a quantum mechanical context, you would represent this field in between, which was in the early version now classical, is something which becomes a dynamical degree of freedom. So the corresponding hopping that you would write down over here, that you have some atom or some fermion or some boson hopping from one lattice side to the other one, would be these operators psi dag and psi over here. But in between, we no longer have a phase, the one that we had written here before, representing this flux through a single plaquette. But, you know, it represents now a certain operator U, which is a link operator. So this is now the quantized, you know, photons, or maybe the gluons in our problem, whatever the underlying lattice gauge theory is that we want to have at the moment. We're just talking about U1 over here. Let me point out now what the key features of such a theory are. The key features is that we have, of course, local symmetries. These are the local gauge symmetries here in the written for the example of the U1. I'm just writing out one part of the Hamiltonian, but I mean, it's quite obvious, you know, from this part over here, that if you make a transformation that the fermion field picks up a certain phase, alpha x, and at the same time you make a transformation that the gauge boson, this quantum variable u over here, picks up the phase on the left and the right-hand side, you can see that these kind of Hamiltonians will be invariant under these kind of transformations, and of course this represents a local symmetry as opposed to a global symmetry. These kind of symmetries are generated by certain generators, jx over here, and it's quite obvious these generators, they live at the different lattice sites over here. These generators at the same time then also represent a certain conserved quantities here. So we have a large number of conserved quantities over here that at the end will be constraints. But let me just mention what the meaning is of these conserved quantities here. You know, the simple example that we talk about here, which is the U1 lattice gauge theory, which is really quantum electrodynamics, it represents actually Gauss' law. So these generators, you can see, have the matter part over here, the density or the corresponding charge, rho down here. And this thing over here will be like a kind of a discretized form of the electric field operator sitting, you know, at the different links that we have here. And of course, these Gauss laws have to be obeyed. You know, if you start out with some initial condition, you know, if this is a fundamental symmetry, then of course it means that you remained in a subsect of your Hilbert space there, for example, which is the subspace corresponding to all of the eigenvalues of this gx, for example, here being equal to zero. Let me illustrate these ideas now in the context, going back to this very simple model, which is the simplest form of this quantum link model, which is this quantum spin ice, you might call it. And let me at the moment only talk about the radiation field, so to say, by itself. So in this case, we represent these different gauge bosons here by spins in a finite dimensional Hilbert space, and we want to choose spin 1/2, 1. Actually, 1/2 is a little bit too simple. We really would like to pick the corresponding representation over here. But all of these relations that we have before can actually be satisfied if these U operators over here is now here the raising operator for the spin sitting on a particular link, and also here the corresponding flux, which is simply the C component of my spin. So let me now work out, you know, examples of what these allowed configurations are obeying the so-called Gauss law. If I take spin 1/2, of course the flux, you know, can point to the right or left corresponding to the two states of the spin. Or in the case of a spin 1, you know, there can be an electric flux pointing to the right. There's a vacuum and one pointing here to the left. But now we can write down here in 2D, for example, different configurations. And these different configurations, you can see, you know, we got this rule. It's called the ice rule from the spin ice. The two go in and two go out, which means that this divergence of this thing over here, the divergence of the electric field is equal to zero. What I'm writing down over here would be the sector where we do not have a charge in the center, but rather the charge is equal to zero. But you can also see right away there will be other configurations, like say three out and maybe two going in here, which means that you get a defect over here. We will afterwards introduce these defects, but we want them to be a quantum degree of freedom, so these defects will be fermions that will be hopping on the lattice, generating then the corresponding electromagnetic field according to these Hamiltonians that we will write down. So these are the different configurations satisfying Gauss law, and you can see that what it means really is that when we got our physical Hilbert space, when we got the Hilbert space over here, we have to make sure that our dynamics really happens in the subspace, you know, of all of these configurations which satisfy this law over here. And this is really the constraint of satisfying Gauss law, which means that we have a physical subspace that we have to work in, though, that implements a certain constraint. This was the generator. This generator is the Gauss law here, and so it involves the electromagnetic field. So at the end, what it means is that we must write down some Hubbert dynamics that will implement then these things as an additional constraint, and this will be the topic now of some of the following discussions. So let me sort of state again, then on this lattice gauge theory, the key part is this, that we have, of course, gauge symmetry as a very fundamental symmetry. In any implementation that you do, this gauge symmetry will always be approximate because, you know, it doesn't come from any fundamental reasons. And in other words, we have to find some mechanism to protect against errors that we wander out from this corresponding subspace. And I've indicated this thing here sort of in a cartoon-like manner. This is a physical space over here of this invariant subspace, and satisfying this Gauss law in the sense that we want Gx, you know, on all states over here to be equal to zero, which means that we don't have any external classical charges in here. We only will have the quantum charges at the very end here. And then, of course, we want to prevent that in our implementation we wander outside in this gauge variant part of the Hilbert space. So we have to do Hamiltonian plus constraints. So when we think about atomic physics implementation for these kind of ideas, I mean, how do we want to do that? And of course, there's a very obvious first answer that we will see afterwards in examples that I will point out, which is to simply copy why you have spin ice in the context of the condensed matter here. And this is simply the idea of energy constraints. If you have spin ice in a condensed matter context, what it means is that you got a certain crystal field, maybe some exchange interactions, so that the low energy configurations satisfy these ice rules that I indicated here before. And so one way of implementing all of that would be that we have some microscopic Hamiltonian, and we simply add now over here the generator squared, you know, as some sort of enforcing that the low energy sector in our theory becomes essentially the one which is the gauge invariant subspace over here. And all of the other, the wrong part of the Hilbert space, this thing out here would be sort of gapped out by some large interactions. What this will mean in practice is that this Gx over here, I've indicated an example here, there would be a fermion here and some spin. You have to implement certain non-local interactions, which is not entirely obvious how to do in an atomic context, but I will afterwards show you certain examples. But it's also clear that this is an emergent lattice gauge theory to the extent that this low energy sector, which is sort of, you know, which has this gap above here with all of the gauge variant states, would be sort of obtained by a certain energy constraint that you put into our models. As I said, I will afterwards give you an example for these things. But there's another way of doing this, which is maybe a little bit interesting from the control point of view, which is that we can also prevent, you know, states to migrate out into the wrong part of the Hilbert space by using essentially classical noise. I jokingly call this thing a classical Zeno effect. And it was really Kai Steinigl in our group who pointed these things out first. And let me just tell you what the basic idea behind it is in the context of a very simple example. Let's think of a two-level system which has ground state and an excited state up here. And we are exciting, say, an atom which sits down here to the excited state. So at the moment, this is the world of Rabi oscillations. You would Rabi oscillate up and down. But let me now add something over here, namely that I would like to wiggle this excited state around. So I'm simply smearing it out by some classical noise. And if I'm doing a very simple Fermi's golden rule calculation for the probability to survive in the ground state, of course, this wiggling around here will lead to some defacing. There will be a certain width of this level up here. And so if I call omega the Rabi frequency, you know, the probability of remaining in the ground state is something like omega squared divided by gamma times t. And so sort of formally, you know, if I make gamma very large, I will remain, you know, in this lower level down here for a longer and longer time, for the very obvious idea that, you know, if I'm, you know, shaking this thing up here, I'm somehow diluting my oscillator strength more and more. And so the probability to wander out sort of is, in this case, actually suppressed. Ideas like this have been used, you know, with cold atoms, the so-called Zeno effect by losses. There are some papers over here in optical lattices that are very useful. So what it means, sort of going back in our context, is that we can actually implement constraints by noise, by putting in white noise into Hamiltonians. And you can see that before we had the Gx squared, which was some complicated interaction. Here we have now some white noise over here with these generators, which are the one generating the corresponding Gauss law. And again, I would like to show an example afterwards to know how these things actually work in the practical context. The nice thing is here that these things are linear in G, so these are really single particle terms, and adding classical noise to the whole story doesn't seem to be very complicated. Of course, all of these things are very much related to these decoherence-free subspaces, bang-bang kind of ideas and so on that have been developed in a quantum information context to decouple systems from an environment. And in our case, of course, it simply means that the Q part of the Hilbert space are the wrong one. We are sort of simply shaking around in a certain way that to prevent that the system sort of migrates out to the wrong part. So now it's time for a simple example, and I start out with this first paper that we wrote here, and which came out, I think, in December last year, where we looked at the most simple example. We did it at the end as a 1D calculation, which is, you know, rather simple and rather trivial, but actually the basic elements to build this thing in the lab are also valid in 2D and also 3D, except that certain parts, like the ring exchange, are a little bit tougher, but we also have some ideas there. But let me confine myself to a 1D discussion in this context. So this is sort of quantum spin ice coupled to a matter field where we want to look at bosons, you know, representing the gauge fields over here that will be actually spins. And then we have fermions, you know, quarks, so to say, under quotes, or the electrons that jump around here. And the kind of models that we will now write in the following will be simply atomic models where we need implementations for the spin degree of freedom as well, of course, for the matter field hopping around. Now, we have sort of, you know, as a test example, experimentalist at the end, we don't only want to build it, but we also would like to see some phenomena. We have looked at the phenomenon of string breaking, which in 1D in this context is rather trivial physically, but it would be interesting to do these things, of course, in higher dimensions, where we are not able to do the corresponding simulations on our normal computers. But that's the reason why we want quantum simulators anyway. So let me just now point out what the basic ingredients are and the kind of models that we want to do. So really what we're doing here is some sort of a Schwinger model, you might call it, you know, U1 fermions plus the gauge bosons in 1D. This is the most simple model that we can invent. And you will have essentially the following degrees of freedom. You know, there will be an electric field. There's no magnetic term here. This makes it much simpler. It simply will be the spin squared. And then we got the hopping term where these fermions are hopping around. And you can see this U over here that we have. Let me rewrite these things now in terms of spin. So this would simply be an SC squared, say of a spin 1. You know, that represents the electric field energy of all of these spins here. Then we have a hopping term over here. And you can see the kind of physics that we have to implement is this, that whenever a particle hops from one lattice side to the other side, sort of from over here, it has to flip the spin over here. And this is the implementation question that we have to ask. And then we add over here also the mass of these quarks or these electrons, whatever you might call them, in terms of what's called here staggered fermions. So for my atomic physics colleagues, I always have to explain these staggered fermions. If you look at this with the eyes of an atomic physicist, of course, what you draw right away would be a super lattice. that, you know, there would be different lattice sites over here having a different kind of a displacement. There would be a mass gap over here. So these excitations, if I do something like that, you know, this would be like making a particle hole pair in this language over here, you know, realized by this very simple sort of, you know, staggered field, which we call as a super lattice in our context, which is very simple to do. Sort of, you know, this means that, you know, the vacuum state in terms of the fermions is that every second one will be filled. So one is working here at one half filling. But if you want to create sort of particle antiparticle pairs over here, you know, in our context, it simply means that this particle is hopping over to the next lattice site. But of course, it will be displaced by this mass gap that we have over here. Let me now focus in on the ingredients that we need on the atomic physics side to do some of these things, like, you know, the first thing, of course, is that we want a spin, but not only a spin. We want the spin to be changeable, like one half and one and so on. And we would like to choose, you know, what kind of spin we have in the experiment, maybe in different days. And one obvious way of doing this would be to represent the spin as Schwinger bosons. Imagine that you have a double well potential and I put atoms inside, like what we get when we take a superfluid mode insulator transition. It allows us to load certain atoms here into these wells. If I take the example of having two bosons in here, and I make this asymmetric well that I have here, you can see right away that we have three different configurations. The two particles can be on the left, one left, right, and two over here. So these are three states. This is exactly what corresponds to a spin one in our context. So we have here n bosons, and by choosing the number of bosons in these double wells, we can choose the spin that we have. And of course, this Wilson kind of lattice gauge theories would come out in the limit that the number of degrees of freedom would become very large, sort of s going to infinity over here. So this is the, you know, corresponding equations over here. This is simply Schwinger bosons, and you can see that now the gauge field is represented by bosonic particles that sit on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side of our link. And the corresponding Hamiltonian that would immediately write down for a system like this would be the one of hopping, you know, but note that there will be a certain difference between the left and right-hand side, this asymmetric well. But right away, you know, the atomic collisions, the interactions that you have over here would be manifested in something that becomes the electric energy in our context. So the atomic interaction parameters sort of give at the very end the different bits and pieces in the Hamiltonian that we want to write. So what about the correlated hopping? So if I write down the hopping, before we said that, you know, if a particle hops over the fermion, that what we want to happen is this, that the spin flips. So if I rewrite the spin now in terms of the Schwinger bosons, you can see that we got now some interaction that involves now four operators. So whenever the particle hops over, we want a boson over here to hop from the left to the right. So if the fermion goes down here, we want the boson to go over here. And you can see that these particles will not hop individually because we have these energy constraints with this offset. But what will happen is this, that of course, if they can exchange energy, overall, this process to this one will be energy conserving. And so in this sense, we are sort of wandering out for a short time when one particle hops and then the other particle hops outside of our gauge invariant Hilbert space. But this is exactly this gap that I talked about now here before. So in other words, the kind of models that we are converging to is this, that the spins we can represent in this form that we have here sites representing the matter field. And then we have these gauge bosons as the link variables that can sit in the left and right-hand side. And with a number of bosonic atoms over here, we can choose what kind of spin that we have in our context. But that's, of course, only half of the story. Let me now switch over to discussion of the Gauss law, which is actually quite interesting in this context. So Gauss law in this context is that we have the electromagnetic field. You know, this is the electric flux. This is the C component of the spin. And this is like the divergence of the electric field over here in this discretized way. We have the background, which is that at every second one in our vacuum, you know, we have the fermion sitting, which is a background charge. And then we have this psi dagger psi. So this is really rho. This is the divergence of this electric field. And of course, we have to build in our theory this constraint that Gx, this operator here on the physical states, is equal to zero. So in the case of a spin one representation, you would simply say, well, the ingredients that we have is this, that you have zeros and one. You know, a fermion can be there or not there on the lattice side. And the different, you know, parts of configurations of the electromagnetic field would be the flux going right, the vacuum, or the flux going left. And now you can start to write down different configurations taking into account this one half that we have up there. You know, that on even sides, for example, something like this would be okay. But, you know, something like this would not be okay because it violates this Gauss law. So we have to eliminate these configurations in terms of constraints. And also similarly here for the oxides, you know that some of these things are not allowed. So building in the constraints, and you can see these constraints are not entirely trivial because they involve now, you know, the spins, two spins, left and right, and at the same time also the charge of our fermions over here. This is not entirely trivial. But actually in our case, if I sort of redraw the model that we had before, you can see here the fermions, and let me now draw the links sort of overlapping. We can see that we have now these double well potentials overlapping with these fermions at different sites over here. We can see that the Gauss constraint in our microscopic model, if you write these things out, sort of at the end of the day comes down to imposing a certain constraint on the number of particles that you have on each of these lattice sites. So what we want in order to impose the Gauss constraint is something that we introduced before, namely the interaction between these particles. And you know, we have to constrain the number of particles over here involving the fermions and these upper boson and then the lower boson over here to be a certain fixed number. So you might call this thing a kind of a supermod insulator because it's not fixing only the number of bosons, but you know, fixing the sum of these different species over here to a certain value. But this is only a question, of course, of tuning the interactions right in order to get something like that. So at that point, we are doing exactly what I said before. We are putting in energy constraints over here that are sort of manageable here in our context by simply using repulsive physics interactions between the particles, which are actually local. So it's really, we have an emergent lattice gauge theory where all of these gauge variance states are gapped out by, you know, adding terms like this to the interaction. So this is this emergent lattice gauge theory that I mentioned before. So I should mention that, you know, we have played around with these microscopic models to do some, you know, phenomena. One of them was the string breaking that I indicated before, that if you introduce some classical charges out here, for example, you know, the ground state of this system over here would be, you know, the longer and longer you make the string go proportion to L, this is the corresponding energy. But, you know, given a certain mass at one point, you know, sort of, you know, the particle, antiparticle can pop out forming here mesons over here, and you would get the vacuum in the middle, so the string will actually break. In 1D, that's rather trivial, okay? But in if you go to higher dimensions, of course, you know, this would be very interesting to observe in an experiment. So it really gets interesting in a non-abelian case, of course, that we're not doing here. So let me add. What? The B squared term. I'm talking about 1D at the moment. That's a very interesting question. We have some ideas at the moment. We have not done it, but I think we have some answers. Okay, so in the non-abelian lattice gauge theory, that's a problem. Okay, in the abelian ones, we have some concrete answers for this B squared term that you want. Okay, yes. So just a few slides about enforcing this Gauss law by classical noise. You know, this should sort of prevent these things going out. And I've drawn now the same model over here. And to cut the long story short, what we do is now that we add noise in order to enforce the Gauss law. And let me show right away some examples. So if I'm adding some gauge not invariant term, this is the one that would, you know, lead to a very bad evolution. This is an error over here. It's not gauge invariant. But if I, you know, take my Gauss law and I wiggle this thing with white noise, instead of, you know, wandering out from the Hilbert space, this is, you know, how the Gauss law really goes wrong. We are doing something fundamentally wrong here. If I'm adding the noise, you can see that we remain up here. This is very close to one. So white noise added in an appropriate way can actually help us to keep, you know, everything in the gauge invariant subspace. And these were calculations done recently by Kai Steinigl. Let me now very briefly, towards the end, okay, say a few words about the non-abelian version of that. And this is rather technical, and so I'd rather just give you the basic flavor of what's happening in this context. So we do these things, as I mentioned before, with fermionic atoms. The basic idea here is this, that in these quantum link models, we have here fermions. You know, this will be fermionic atoms having now different colors, sort of different internal states, sitting at these lattice sites over here. And we got these non-abelian gauge fields in between. And non-abelian here means that we have this IJ color index here, so our Hamiltonian for the hopping, I'm just writing out this part over here, we'll now have indices I that we are summing over all of these degrees, which is the color index going from 1 to n over here. Of course, you have to pick a certain group and all of these kind of things, like U and SUN or maybe SO3 or something like that. And now what's interesting about these quantum link models, and this really comes to rescue us in this context, I have to say, for the atomic implementation is this, that in these quantum link models, the UIJ matrices over here are represented by operators, and we have what's called here a fermionic reshown representation, you know, of these U over here. So this is not the standard lattice, non-abelian lattice gauge theory. This is really in the context of these quantum link models. And you can see that these are now fermions before we had bosons over here. So it's very similar, but notice over here, we only need fermions. So at the very end, in doing these things, it will be much simpler than the example that I showed you actually here before. So what's the point of doing that, these quantum link models? You can see right away that we gain a lot in our context here, because this interaction here for the hopping becomes here actually, this becomes a separable interaction, as you can see. So what it means is this, that you got some particles over here. So if I take a particle, you know, and take another one over here, this thing essentially means that this is a correlated hop. So we just have to make sure by putting some interactions over here that when a particle hops here, this hops over here. So this allows us to implement these kind of interactions, and therefore, this actually, by the way, is from the very beginning, gauge invariant. I should notice that, you know, at the moment, we are sort of on the way of playing a little bit around with doing some sort of nuclear physics, you might call it, you know, putting some of these things here together to do some, you know, interesting things that are talking about bound states of some of these objects and so on. But the last point I would like to emphasize here is this, that this implementation that I talked about here is one which is, I think, relatively clever here in the following sense, that the fundamental local symmetries that we have on the side of these non-abelian lattice gauge theories are mapped in these implementations into something which in our atomic physics implementations are local conservation laws. The basic building blocks are these kind of crosses here, where we have fermions that hop over here. You know, they are, here they are matter fields, here they are regions, and they hop around. But you know, these, the number of particles here, in the way that we design the lattice, it's actually constant. So the fundamental symmetries are mapped over to local particle number conservation, which we really know how to engineer very well. So in this sense, you know, local symmetries mapped over this way, I think that this is probably the way to implement some of these ideas and obey these local symmetries. So in this sense, let me summarize. I've talked a little bit about this U1 and also non-abelian lattice gauge theories over here, which we believe can be mapped onto atomic boson Fermi mixtures and maybe also multi-species Fermi gases over here. No, there's this problem here in general that we have here Hamiltonians, plus we have to do the Gauss constraints. There's different ways of doing that. I find the classical noise one to be particularly amusing. This means that we can sort of average away things that we don't want to happen and therefore be more gauge invariant for a longer time. But maybe the right thing to do is really to find microscopic Hamiltonians, which from the very beginning are gauge invariant. And sort of the final statement is that we are on our way actually to find simpler and thus more realistic implementations. I have to say that we started out over here, but sort of the more time progresses, we realize that we can actually use our atomic physics knowledge in a simpler way and therefore also a more realistic way to build some of these models. So I'm actually very hopeful that in an experiment, these quantum link models are not completely unrealistic, but of course it will always remain tough. Here's this collaboration with people. These are people from Innsbruck over here. David Marcos worked on the superconducting implementation I didn't have time to talk about. Marcello Dal Monte was really fundamental in putting all of these papers here together, together with Enrique. And Markus Müller is a student who moved now to Madrid, participate in these things. And this is the team from the Bern University. And this is Uwe Jens Wiese, who taught us all these things about quantum link models. And that allowed us to translate some of these physics into cold atoms. Here's the superconducting stuff. If you want to hear that, you can ask me. And you know, and I should also mention at the very end with my last sentence, I've talked about optical lattices, but there are some other ideas around now, like to do superconducting vortex lattices for atoms with a promise to have much, much better energy scaling by making much smaller lattices in terms of maybe 50 nanometers. So maybe optical lattices, you know, there could be a parallel interesting development where all these energy scales combined with some nano engineering of these lattices are a promising way to do this thing, not only in optical lattices, but also in a somewhat different context here. Okay, with this, I would like to thank you.
Thank you, Peter. So we have time for some questions, please. Yes, John?
I didn't really show it, okay. I didn't really show it, and I think it needs actually a separate discussion. So what we do in this context here is that We represent the spin over here. This is a Schwinger bosons represented by some cavities over here. And then we have some qubits, you might call them, over here. And then this is sort of, you know, a mapping at the very end, which leads over to certain circuits that implement these kind of ideas. The main problem in this context is, of course, all of the dissipation that you have. This sets a certain time scale, and then Gauss law goes wrong. And so dissipation is really a major problem here. But for a short time of evolution, I think it will be sufficient. Okay, well, in this case over here, we are not doing really gate operations in the sense of quantum computation. It's really more like an analog simulation where you have to start out with the right part of the Hilbert space, and then we can do certain flips, for example, and implement these correlated hops that have a certain fidelity, but I can tell you then some details about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
What were the observables that you would look for, and how would you see them?
Okay, so in the case of this string breaking, for example, you would like to look at the electromagnetic field, which are the photons in this case, and you would like to see that at the very beginning, you know, when you have two classical charges over here that are boundary conditions, there would be an electric field, you know, that points in a certain direction. This would be a certain spin state. So by reading the spin state, you know how to do that. And then, of course, if the string breaks, it means its middle part is in the vacuum, but you have some mesons on the side. So if you think of something like an atomic microscope, this quantum gas microscope, you could read the state of the electric field here, the corresponding flux states directly, and of course also then for the matter field. Yeah.
So just a quick remark. I also found it very amusing to see white noise coming back and helping us in a productive way. In fact, it's one of the early ideas to keep, even quantum computation confined to the coherent tree. And even Almut Bige and Dan Brown back in time. So I was wondering, because we know that formally this strategy can be equivalent also to strong continuous measurements or like dynamical decouplings or energetic protections. In these cases, the classical noise is by far the easiest options, or are the other alternatives also worth being kept in mind?
Well, I have to say that, you know, initially when I thought about adding dissipation to enforce this Gauss constraint, I was always thinking about quantum noise that not only prevents going out but also pumps back. But at the end, this is so complicated, and it was really Kai Starnigel who pointed out to me that you don't really need that. And the classical noise to make it correlated is a single particle term that, you know, correlates certain, three sides is actually almost trivial experimentally.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, this is so easy. Yeah. I mean, it's not a complete fix, of course, because it means that it's only valid for a certain amount of time, but you can really sort of, you know, noise away some of these unwanted interactions in a way that it helps, I think, a lot.
Or maybe you can combine with other strategies to keep it longer or something like that.
So all of these old ideas come back to work here in a useful way.
Okay, so if the gauge symmetry is not exact, there will be terms in the Hamiltonian that are small at the scale of the lattice spacing, if you know, simulated it well. But in the renormalization group sense, these will be highly relevant, or grow rapidly as you go to longer distances. So do you anticipate that as a result there will be serious limitations on how large a system size you can simulate?
Well, I would say that the models that we have over here, of course, we can do relatively large sizes, but to be honest, we haven't really thought much about the continuum limit. At the moment, we just look at these lattice gauge models that are for us given, and we would like to know what their implementation is. So you're talking about the next step in our thinking, and I think we also need some education from the people who really know lattice gauge theory to teach us what the right questions are.
Particularly about what you expect for the effect of Hamiltonian. You haven't discussed Plaquette terms, which are required.
Okay. So in the case of the U1, the Plaquette terms are the magnetic field terms, I should maybe mention, you know, that correspond essentially to ring exchange. We wrote a paper actually here at KITP maybe 6 or 7 years ago that was how to implement ring exchange terms. So we do have some ideas for these things. In the case of these non-abelian quantum link models, they amount to certain Riesz moves, you know, these Plaquettes that are rather complicated. So we have some ideas how to do that. But this is not very very well developed. So I would say that the whole toolbox without the Plaquette term is here. Okay, the Plaquette terms are kind of tough. But I think it's only a question of sitting down and developing these things, so this will come. So this is really gauge theory in a strongly coupled limit.
Okay, so let's move on. Let's thank Peter again. So the next speaker in this morning's session is Paul Yessen from University of Arizona, Tucson.